This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Welcome to the Global Philosophy of Religion Project at the University of Birmingham, run by Professor Yujin Nakasawa. We at Closer to Truth are thrilled to collaborate. Hamza Yousef Hansen is president of Zaytuna College in Berkeley, California, the first accredited Muslim liberal arts college in the United States, a proponent of the liberal arts and great books education in both the Western and Muslim traditions. He has numerous scholarly publications on religion and contemporary ethical concerns. Hamza, it's a real pleasure to meet.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Robert.
Let's talk about God in Islam. Obviously, God is the center of Islam. But I want to ask that in Islamic history and tradition, are arguments for the existence of God prevalent? Do you find them in discussions as we do in some other religions?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the most merciful, the most compassionate. Prayers and peace be upon our prophet and all the prophets. First of all, arguments for the existence of God are certainly, I think, rife in the Islamic tradition. A lot of people don't know that, in fact, the Catholic tradition that also works with reason and revelation is heavily influenced by the Muslim tradition. And so you'll find in the five ways of Aquinas, a good deal of the material that Aquinas was working with came out of some of the great Muslim philosophers like Al-Farabi, Avicenna, who's Ibn Sina in our tradition, certainly Averroes, Ibn Rushd, and Imam al-Ghazali. So we do have a very strong tradition. It's called the Kalam tradition. And in fact, William Lane Craig, who's one of the great, arguably one of the great Christian philosophers of this age, has devoted his life almost to the promotion of a distinctly Muslim argument for the existence of God, which is called the Kalam cosmological argument. And he wrote a book. Even though he is a Christian, he's using Muslim theologians as the basis for his argument.
Yes, we've had Bill on, and we've talked about that. So that is absolutely the case. Are there disputes about it? Is there any traditions within the Islamic civilization where some people argued against the existence of God through some various types of philosophical or practical kinds of arguments?
Well, I think you've always had atheists and agnostics. That goes back to the ancient peoples. I mean, you have before Christ, you have Leucippus, you have people like Lucretius, who are materialists. De Rerum Natura is a great work in the Western tradition that looks at that. So within the Islamic tradition, you do have people that did not believe. You had arguments for why people shouldn't believe. Some of the great disbelievers debated openly. Like in Iraq, Abu Hanifa is famous for debating materialists. There's a great story of one of his debates where he showed up very late, and the man complained about him being late, and he said, unfortunately, he was stopped at the river, and there was no boat to get him across the Tigris, but fortunately, a tree fell and formed into a boat, so he was able to come across and be on be there for the thing. And the man said, "That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard." And he said, "Well, your argument that all of this just appeared naturally without any maker is as absurd to me as the idea that a tree turned into a boat on its own."
Yeah, that's a great story. I think that debate is healthy, even if you are a believer, irrespective of the religion. To engage in thoughtful debate is certainly one aspect of a religious conviction. I think that's very healthy. It's not the only thing that religious people do, obviously, but I think it contributes to a deeper understanding.
Absolutely, and I think tradition is strongest when it's engaged with counter arguments. I mean, that's how really how theology emerges out of these great world religions is due to people who were opposed to it. Mm. And so they had to make arguments for why they actually believe what they believe. So reason and revelation is very important in the Islamic tradition, as well as the Jewish and the Christian in the great scholastic iterations of the Abrahamic faith.
Right. In your essay, Suffering and Surrender, you address the trials and tribulations that we all come across in the world. You have a statement, which I want to highlight, says, only God brings forth good from evil. So I want to ask you, how does Islam address the problem of evil? Why the enormity of evil in a world that was created supposedly by a God that is all good and all powerful?
Yeah, I mean, this is the great bugbear of really the world, I mean, let alone religious traditions. And I think the argument for atheism, obviously one of the strongest arguments is the argument of the existence of evil. If Allah is all good, how could there be this evil world? From the perspective of Muslims, we see that God is the creator of the heavens and the earth, that this is his dominion, that anything he does in his dominion is his prerogative. And we don't in any way, God is God, and we are who we are. The Quran says very clearly that God does not oppress people, but they themselves were oppressing themselves and also oppressing one another. So the way the Muslim scholars looked at it really was this idea that if I have a cloak and I burn the cloak, you can say, why are you burning that perfectly good cloak? And I say, well, it happens to be infected with a very dangerous infectious disease. So us judging why God does things is something that the Muslims have really shied away from. The Quran says God will not be asked about what he does, but you will be asked about what you do. And so obviously there are different theodicies. There's a theodicy that, and by theodicy I mean the you know, explanations of evil, of why there is evil. And certainly one of the most important ones is that the existence is binary. And the Quran says in the 36th chapter that God has created everything in pairs. And so in order for good to be known, there has to be evil. The Arabs say, by opposites, things are known. And also moral agency, because we have natural evil, like a tsunami. And then we have moral evil, which is where a moral agent does something. If a lion eats a human being, we can't impose on that lion our moral sensibilities and say that it was evil. Although people do that and will kill the animal for doing something that by its nature it does. But we can question our own actions. And I think one of the greatest arguments for the existence of God is why we're offended by evil.
Mm. Mm. So in the Muslim tradition, does the problem of evil as a problem discussed? Or
it's not a problem in the same way that you find in the Western tradition. Right. I think the Muslims really did not, because they saw that this is God's dominion. And he cannot, you cannot be an oppressor in your own dominion if everything belongs to you. What you do with it is your own business. And so there was this idea that God has, the world is filled with good, and it's filled with difficulty, and it's filled with joy and sorrow. And these are all ways in which human beings grow. They can only be understood if it's only this world, then absolutely it doesn't make any sense. But if you have a day of judgment where rights are wrong, there's a verse in the Quran that says, "La zulm al-yawm," there is no oppression on this day. Everybody will have their due. Those who were merciful in the world, mercy will be shown to them. Those who were judgmental in the world, like Christ said, by the standard by which ye judge, you too shall be judged. So if you were somebody who always wanted justice in the world, God will give you justice in the next world. But for those of us, I'm much more interested in mercy. Like, I want to see a social mercy movement as opposed to a social justice movement, because I think a lot of what's happening in the world is actually our just deserts for being who we are. So I just wanted to add to that, that one of the, in Arabic, the word for evil has a lot of different meanings. It's not so much evil per se, but like poverty is called shar. That's the word. So anything that's deficient is called evil. And one of the things that I think people ask, where is God with all this, all these horrors in the world? But from a Muslim perspective, God has more right to ask us as our creator, where are you? Because the Quran says, had it not been for some people to constrain other people, the entire world would be filled with evil. And so I think it's really important to remember one of the things that Helen Keller said is that while the world is filled with evil, it's also filled with the overcoming of evil. And I think we often focus solely on the evil and use that as an excuse for not recognizing the extraordinary good that exists in the world.
Mm. But in the Muslim understanding, God at least created the capacity that there would be evil in the world. I know many Christians have difficulty with that concept.
Yeah, it's actually one of the six fundamental beliefs. We have to believe in the measuring out of good and evil, that evil is part of the world.
Okay, let's go on to the Muslim understanding of how can we know God. Your essay, The Prayer of the Oppressed, was a very long and thoughtful approach to our own personal situation. Obviously, God is in that. Does that concept of the prayer of the oppressed, does that lead to avenues that could lead to God?
One of the quickest ways in which people begin to actually awaken to the possibility of God is when they're confronted with great pain and suffering. It opens up the heart. There's a tradition of our prophet, peace be upon him, that says that God is with the brokenhearted. That very often it's the breaking of the heart that allows the light of God to come into the heart. So I think it's very important to recognize that from our perspective, suffering is redemptive. Suffering is something that can actually be an incredible catalyst for spiritual growth and change. One of the things, knowledge of God in the Islamic tradition, although we have a very profound scholastic tradition and we have great theologians who used philosophy to make their arguments, but there's also a very, I think, profound, simple belief that inheres in just the common Muslim that's quite stunning. And I think you see this in other faith traditions where the faith is deeply rooted. The way that they deal with suffering, the way they deal with pain, the way they deal with loss in life is quite extraordinary. I think that becomes a very profound proof of the power of faith to enhance our lives and to make our lives. You know, Marx said that faith was an opium of the masses, but what a lot of people, they quote that, but what he actually said was that faith was, it was the cry of a heart in an unjust world. It was a cri de coeur of an unjust world. And so in essence, what he was saying was religion numbs the pain of the world. Well, one of the things that Marxists and their minions and others have done is they've gotten rid of religion. And so now I would argue opium has become the opium of the masses. Like, people need opium to numb the pain of the world, whereas in the past it was by turning to God that one found solace. And we have great examples of that.
So we have the philosophical tradition. You now have the personal experiential condition of needing God or seeing God through trials and tribulations. Let's go further. There is in Islam, as in many of the traditions, a mystical tradition. Can religious and mystical experiences tell us about God? For example, Islamic mystics, do they know more about God than Islamic non-mystics? Or for that matter, do they know more than analytical philosophers of religion?
There's a great story of a great philosopher, Ibn Rushd, who met with a great mystic who was also a scholar and a philosopher, but he's primarily known for his mysticism. His name was Ibn Arabi. So Averroes said to him, is what we arrive at the same as what you arrive at? In other words, is our discursive knowledge of God the same as your experiential knowledge of God? And Ibn Arabi is reported to have said, yes. And then Ibn Rushd smiled, and then Ibn Arabi said, no. And so I think, you know, in the Islamic tradition, experiential knowledge of God is far more profound than discursive knowledge of God. One of the great scholars and mystics of Islam, Ibn Athaylah, who was from Egypt, he said that that the attempt to prove the existence of God is from the perspective of the absence of God. And then he says, but when was God absent that he needed to be proved? And so the idea is that there are people that genuinely experience God. In that same book, which is called The Aphorisms, translated by Victor Danner, a good translation in English, one of the things that he says is, whoever knows the truth sees the truth in everything. And so the Quran says, we created the heavens and the earth with truth. So there is goodness in everything. And that's why that knowledge of God, which is a natural knowledge of God, is much more powerful than the artificial knowledge that comes through this discursive thinking. Intuition, and this is what Imam al-Ghazali writes in his famous Munqidh min al-Dalal, the savior from error. He writes that he studied these different ways of knowing, like epistemology, and concluded that the most profound way was the way of direct experience, what's called in Arabic ma'rifa, or gnosis of God. It's a direct, immediate experience of God. And it's far more profound, especially for the person, obviously, that experiences it, but to believe in it is a type of experience. So those of us who might not have had the experience, we believe in those who have. And certainly the prophets are the foremost among them.
For those of us who have not had such experiences and seek to know God, are we in an inferior position then?
I think in terms of a degree of understanding, absolutely. The problem is, obviously, is there are a lot of charlatans that abuse this type of knowledge for those who believe in it that haven't experienced it. And you find that too many of our religions and of our sects are filled with these type of people who claim to have this knowledge. Right. And usually one of the signs that they don't have the knowledge is that they make the claim that they have the knowledge.
I like that.
That's our tradition. It's a big red flag, because the true Gnostics are people that Imam al-Ghazali says that a tree that has great fruit, the branches hang low. And so there's a type of humility that comes with that, they don't see themselves as anything.
I've worried that if I had, which I've not had, that type of mystical experience, I would not believe it. I would think it's some neurochemical imbalance that I had, or not enough sleep, or some other explanation. So what is it that can differentiate?
We have a whole science of that. So we have a science in our tradition that deals with mystical experiences. So for instance, there's experiences that are outward terrestrial sensory experiences. Then there's outward terrestrial meaning experiences, outward celestial meaning experiences. Then there's inward terrestrial sensory experiences, like for instance, some certain psychotropic drugs are very similar. Like I actually believe that I had a profound mystical experience on fentanyl. It wasn't illegal. It was actually given to me in the hospital. But I had an extraordinary experience. And William James writes about this in Varieties of Religious Experience. So I think people, drugs, unfortunately, are one of the vehicles for opening a lot of people up to the possibility, because there's an experience that there's more here than meets the eye, quite literally. And I think materialists try to reduce those things to neurological phenomena. But the reality of it is that consciousness itself is a spiritual experience. People ask me, you know, I want to have a spiritual experience. My response to that is, you are having a spiritual experience. It's just mediated through your sensoria. But this whole thing is mystical. Consciousness is mysticism. The fact that we can communicate and speak in language, the fact that I can say these words, I don't know where they're coming from, and you don't know where yours are coming from. The fact that I'm speaking at this rapid rate, and your mind is digesting all of these things, putting them together. You have all this past experience that enables you to even understand what I'm talking about. This phenomena, which is happening constantly, it's miraculous. And it's just amazing that people in this kind of perfunctory attitude towards existence, I feel sorry for them.
From the standpoint of Islam, do all or most religions, the ones we know, worship the same God?
Do they worship the same God? I think we're all, particularly in the Abrahamic religions, we're certainly talking about the same God. Some of us know people that, for instance, you might know somebody and I know somebody and we share that, but then we've had very different experiences of those people. So you begin to describe a person, I say, that doesn't sound like the person I know, but it is the same person. And so I think in many ways, this is the way we look at God. We have different perspectives, and those perspectives color our understanding of God. But the God that we're talking about is the creator of the heavens and the earth, sustainer of all things animate and inanimate. And this is the God of even the Hindus, despite all of their various manifestations and things. If you get into the Vedic scriptures, you'll find that they're really talking about a very similar understanding of what they call it, the nirguna, as opposed to the sirguna, the unattributable God, the God, the unknowable God. And so the Godhead, the unknowable Godhead, I think is the same for all of us. When we get into attributes, I think then there's going to be some differences.
The argument is that when you look for that commonality, the lowest common denominator, to be a bit pejorative, you wind up with almost nothing, just a kind of a ground of being, and you lose all meaning. Is that
I think that's excellent, because there's a great section in the Dostoevsky's The Possessed, where Shatov, he's got this character Shatov, he was an atheist, and then he kind of has this, he comes back to his faith in America of all places, And one of the things that he says is that every nation has their own understanding of God. And if it wasn't for that, they wouldn't be a nation. They wouldn't have their distinct character. Okay. And I think it's a very profound insight. For nation, I would say ummah, which is the community, the ecclesia, the sanghai, the minyan, all those things that bring a people together, that make them unique and distinct. So I think there's a verse in the Quran, which is very interesting to me, that it says, every people, we have given them a way, a shir'ah, a way, and a minhaj. In Hebrew, they call it a minhag. That they have their own particular way. And it says, we did this as a test. So vie with one another in good. And so each community is going to see itself as unique, and it is in reality unique. But the real challenge is to prove yourself through virtue, and that's where the moral character of a community becomes so important. Because by their fruits ye shall know them, as Christ said.
The challenge to that, of course, is that sounds good, but each of the major faiths, even if we stick within the Abrahamic tradition, there are overt contradictions between them. To pick religions that I'm more familiar with between Judaism and Christianity, obviously the incarnation and divinity of Jesus, the nature of the Trinity. These are fundamental differences. And of course, Islam brings the prophet into it. So how then do you deal with what on their surface appear to be outright contradictions?
Well, I mean, first of all, we have to remember that the Jewish tradition recognizes both Islam and Christianity as Noahides. So
yeah.
within Judaism, we're actually we're Noahidic people. We follow the at least seven of the Ten Commandments. So the Jews have never had a problem with the theology of the Muslims, and in fact have used it. I mean, they were influenced by the Kalam tradition. Some of the great Jewish philosophers, like Moshe ben Maimon, Maimonides, and others. Both of us, the Jews and the Christians, do have a problem with the Trinity. So we would both see the Trinity as a serious problem. We actually think it's an error. And it's very easy to see triads everywhere. That we have a whole science called trigonometry, which just deals with three. So three is a very powerful number. In some ways, because it's really the... You know, in Arabic tradition, numbers begin with two, not one. One is not considered a number in Arabic, but two is the first number, and it's from the two that comes the third. So all of creation comes out of the binary, and the male, the female coming together brings the third. And so, and then we're triune. We have a rational, we have an irascible and concupiscent soul. So it's easy to see how they fell into that mistake, but we believe it's a mistake. It doesn't mean that there's not great truths in Christianity. They're profound truths, but there can be errors. The Christians have had since the beginning a Unitarian tradition that has challenged the Trinity.
Let's talk about the attributes of God in the Islamic tradition and in Islamic philosophy. I'm familiar with the 99 names of God.
Right.
In the Islamic tradition, and I'm also familiar in the philosophy of religion, particularly from the Christian tradition, some very sophisticated analytic philosophy dealing with perfect being theology. What does it mean for God to be perfect? Omnipotence, the omni-God, omnipotence, all-powerful, omniscience, all-knowing, omnipresent, everywhere, omnibenevolent, all-good, timelessness, unchanging. How do the 99 names in Islam articulate with the omni-perfect being of God of Christianity?
Well, we have two traditions. So we have a type of natural theology, which is Kalam, which works largely with reason. And from that, 13 attributes were identified by reason as necessary for God, seven of which are central. And then the others come out of the seven.
What are some of those? Give me an example.
Well, the first one is aseity, that God has existence, wujud, and that existence he exists in and of himself, and nothing brought him into existence.
Okay.
So he has absolute existence, absolute being. In Arabic, the word is wujud, which is a beautiful word because it means. It means, you know, if I can coin a term, findability. It's, in other words, God can be found. And because wajada, the Arabic root is to find. But also it means to be ecstatic. Because when you discover something like the Eureka moment of Archimedes coming out of the bathtub and apparently running down the streets of his village shouting Eureka because he discovered displacement. The joy of finding God is the greatest joy. And, it's a joy that children already live in. So, I mean, very, very young children. So, but we forget, you know, we leave the Garden of Eden and we enter into, a world that does have demonic and dark forces working to divert us from that. And so then it becomes an epic journey. Back to God. So that's the first. And then that he is living. In other words, God has chayim in Hebrew, same root. That God has life. That God is all hearing. That He's all seeing. That He has power. That He has will. And His will and His power and His knowledge are the three attributes that bring everything into existence. He wills things into existence. And I'm using He. Muslims do not have any gender association with God. God is neither male nor female. God has beautiful attributes, and He has and He has majestic attributes. It's in He's called Dhul Jalali wal Ikram. So in the revealed philosophy, the revealed theology, there are 121 names of God mentioned in the Quran. The 99 names were specific for if somebody memorizes them and understands them, the Prophet said that he will enter paradise. So those specific names have a special place. But the names of God are infinite. We have a tradition that says, you know, by every name that you have taught us or that you have withheld to your own knowledge. So God has infinite number of names, but we know the names, and there are names that the Prophet gave us that aren't in the 99 names, like Manan and Hanan, but they're beautiful names. The Jewish tradition, I think, has 72 names that they also honor, but they're beautiful. And I think St. Francis Assisi, after he met the Muslims, he came back and incorporated some of those practices by calling on the divine names, because Muslims call on the divine names. He also raised the cross up to a Tao.
I think you differentiated among the names between the 13 and then the 7 and the subset of that are the kind of
like the 7, which has existence, has life, has power, has will, has knowledge and hearing and seeing. Those are the 7.
Okay.
And from those you get that he is al mutakallim, he is the speaker. So they differentiate between the attribute and the if I could use it, I mean it's not the right word, but the embodiment of the attribute that inheres in the essence.
Okay. So now then, what are the other? If that's the core category, then what are all the others? 121 minus 13 or 99 minus 13?
Names like the beautiful. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said that God is beautiful and He loves beauty.
Okay.
And also that He's majestic. So for instance, the joy of experiencing a sunset is from apotheosis of God's beauty. It's a tajalli, it's a manifestation of that beauty. Whereas a tsunami is a manifestation of His jalal, of His majesty. And so the Muslims distinguish between these two. And they're not mutually exclusive. So God is just and He's merciful. And so a lot of people don't know how to square justice and mercy. But God will show mercy to those who show mercy, and He will be just with those who did not show mercy.
Is it proper, given those names, to describe God as a person? And I ask because in Christianity, there's a fairly heated dispute in whether God is a person. And a person has personhood features like awareness and intent and will. Or is that an anthropomorphizing of what should be a very deep and impersonal ground of being? That's the tension in Christianity, in philosophy of religion in Christianity.
I'm much more familiar with the Catholic tradition than the Protestant and the Orthodox. And, personhood in Western Catholic metaphysics is according to Jacques Maritain, is basically it's the immaterial nature, even the personhood, there's a distinction between the person and the individual. So the individual is what relates to their material nature and to the accidents that have been acquired in the world from their background and their experiences. Whereas the person is something that transcends that. It gets to the core essence of the human being. And so the idea in Western Christianity that God is a person, in other words, that is how we're able to communicate with God. In the Islamic tradition, we don't use that term, person. But there is a verse in the Quran where Jesus says, God, you know what is in my soul, myself, but I don't know what's in yourself. And so there is an idea that we are created in this metaphysical image. The Imago Dei enables us to know God. So even though the Muslims use the word surah, the form, because what is the only way we can know things metaphysically, the only way we can know things is through their form. So I know a dog because of the form that the dog presents itself with, and I'm able to abstract the universal out of that. God is formless, and so in that way, God is unknowable. So there, this is the via negativa. This is the, in Arabic, it's called tariqat al-salbiya. It's the path that we know God through what God is not. And this is why the most fundamental verse about God, which is in the 42nd chapter of the Quran, it's the 11th verse, it says, Laysa kamithlihi shay. There is nothing like God. And yet, and then it says, and yet, God hears all and sees all. So the only way we can know what all hearing and all seeing is because God has made us creatures that see and hear. He's given us will. He's given us life. He's given us speech. So the Quran says, in your own souls, don't you see? In other words, don't you see this manifestation of these divine attributes in yourself? You are not God, but it's through yourself you know God. And this is why we have, it's an apocryphal tradition, but it's quoted often that whoever knows his self knows his Lord.
Mm. How does that articulate with, in Western philosophy of religion, the apophatic, or can only know God in the negative, and the cataphatic tradition where you can know affirmative characteristics of God?
Well, this is, in our tradition, it's called tashbih and tanzih, which is loosely immanence and transcendence. They don't have identical correspondences, but what I would say is that even though I have hearing, any number over infinity is zero. So in that way, I can know something of what that means, that God hears and God sees and God's alive. But at the same time, because it's a thing over infinity, it's canceled out. And so in that way, we can know, but at the same time, we can't know.
In Islam, what's the relationship between the creator, God, Allah, and the created, the world as we know it?
Well, the most important is that all of creation is in submission to God, except for the human being and the spirit world, like what are daemon in Greek, they would call them the daemon. These creatures that can, they're spirit creatures and they're either good or they're bad. But we, the two of us, have been given free will. And so the human being has God has given us the ability to choose. Unlike everything else in creation, everything, according to the Quran, everything is praising God. For instance, in our tradition, the two times that are very important to have special time set aside for praise are the dawn period and the sunset period. Well, you'll notice that a lot of creation is doing that. So you'll see birds literally gather and start chirping and singing. Now, you can have evolutionary biologists explain that, but from our perspective, they're actually praising God. And so we do that consciously. They do it simply by their nature. And so this is what we're called to do. We're called to enter in to a covenant with God freely and wholeheartedly, and to worship God. And we worship God by recognizing first and foremost that God is our creator. And so that is saying that there is nothing worthy of worship except the one true living God, which is La ilaha illallah. There is no God except the one true God. And that God communicates to his creation. through revelation and through inspiration. And so the prophets have revelation and the saints have inspiration. And ordinary people can have it. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said that a true dream is 1/46 of prophecy. So even common people, even people that aren't believers, have access to true dreams, like the Pharaoh in the story of Joseph.
Mm. How does this God intervene in human affairs, whether in individual lives or in the flow of history?
Well, I think you have to open yourself. First of all, the Quran says every day God is on a new affair. And so everything that we see, the flower blooming, the fruit ripening, we see this, everything is just God is doing all of this. And so it's opening up to that relationship. It's literally opening your heart to the light of God, which is everywhere. And fanaticism is being blinded by that light, and true spirituality is being guided by that light. And so finding that balance. One of the things about the world is the vanity fair, this idea of pilgrim's progress. You come into the world and then there's this vanity fair that literally can sideline you and preoccupy you until death shows up. And when death comes, the Quran says you can't put it off. And so it's really a preparation. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, taught us to reflect on death every single day. He said to wake up in the morning not expecting to reach the evening, and to go to sleep at night not expecting to wake up in the morning. Muslims are actually told to live like that so that they really take advantage of the preciousness and the gift of life. It's something to really be appreciated. And it also brings you into the moment. We have a saying in our tradition that Sufi Ibn Waqtihi, that the true mystic is in the moment. They're present. And so getting into this presence and being aware of the presence of God is really at the fundamental core of Islamic practice, which is why we pray five times a day. We go back. The baseline is five times a day. Many people pray a lot more than that, but the baseline is five times a day.
There's an argument in particularly in Christian philosophy of religion about God as the creator and God as the sustainer. There's some views that God created the universe of all that exists, all reality, but is independent from it. Another view is that God is so intimately associated with the creation that if God in some way stopped willing the creation on a continuous basis, the creation would disappear.
Right.
Does Islam deal with that kind of differentiation between God the creator as an event and God the sustainer on a continuing basis?
The Quran is very clear that every moment God is sustaining it. And if God turned away from creation for one iota, the entire thing would disappear. So there's a verse in the Quran that says that we will show them our signs in themselves and on the horizon. The horizon is the meeting place of the heaven and the earth. The self is the meeting place of the heaven and the earth. We are soul and body that's come together. And so God will show us in ourselves and on the horizon, in that meeting place of heaven and earth, until it becomes clear that this is the truth. And then it says, does it not suffice that God is witnessing all things? So that witnessing is what enables existence to take place. It's the divine, providential witnessing of creation that sustains it. And if that was removed for an instant, it would be gone. The most important verse in the Quran, it's in the second chapter. It's called the master verse. It begins, Allahu la ilaha illahu al-hayyul qayyum. God, there is no God but that one true God, the living and the sustainer. And so God is sustaining in every instant. And becoming aware of that is really becoming aware of the presence of God in your life. Somebody once asked me, he asked me about Islam, and I told him, well, it's just a gratitude for the gifts that God gives us. And he said to me, I suppose God's given me some gifts in my life. And I just looked at him, I said, who do you think's sustaining your temperature right now at 98.6? You know, it's like, that's God, you know, and when he makes you sick, he does it for a wisdom. And when he gives you health, he does it. So in sickness, we're patient, and in health, we're grateful. And that's why these are the two great attributes in the Quran of the believer: patience in tribulation, gratitude in blessings.
I assume in Islam, it does not make sense to ask the question that is often done in philosophy of religion in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and in that when God intervenes, assume there's a God and assume that God does intervene, you believe that, does God violate the laws of nature, the laws of physics, when God intervenes, whether in our minds or intervenes with so-called miracles or intervenes in history? Is there a violation of physical law? That's a meaningless question.
Yeah, we wouldn't use the word violation. We would say that first of all, quantum physics theoretically violates all these Newtonian laws. And so the Prophet Muhammad said that the unseen world to the seen world, the ratio of this seen world, which is called the mulk in the Quran, in relation to the malakut, he said, is like an iron ring in the midst of a vast desert. So what's unseen is so much greater than what's seen. So we make these assumptions about laws, but most of these are dialectical. They're not demonstrative. Most laws are dialectical. They're not demonstrative laws. In fact, we have to use Legendre domain in our mathematics to even measure motion. So we take curves and we turn them into these infinitely small straight lines in order to measure. It's all approximations. So when you look at the world, your assumptions about what are laws, I mean, there are observable laws, but are they the ultimate truth? No, they're saving the appearances generally. In traditional logic, they would be seen as dialectical and not apodictic or demonstrative.
In Islam, what do we say about the salvation process or eschatological speculations about the future of Earth? These are obviously prevalent in Judeo-Christian tradition. How are they in Islam?
Bismillah. I think the most important thing is that we all share. I know there's a debate in the Jewish tradition, but generally we share this idea of a day of judgment, that there is a day when the debts fall due. There's no free lunch, as they say. So your life is going to be taken to account, and we will have to answer for what we did here. And so we believe in a day of judgment. The Quran says that just as the universe was spread out, God will, the big crunch at the end, it says God will roll it up like a scroll at the end. So the universe will go back into that singularity point that it began from. And all of the souls are going to be raised up, and we will meet on a plane, and then we will go through a reckoning. And there will be intercession. There will be prophets interceding for their peoples. We believe that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, has this great intercession. Christ will intercede. All of the prophets will have their intercessions. And then the judgment comes. So the Quran says there's a group destined for the fire, and there's a group destined for paradise. And so, you know, this, it's interesting because you find this in so many religious traditions. And it's hard to believe that this simply came out of the imaginations of people.
So this has been terrific. I've learned about the God of Islam. I've always wanted to learn more. That's one of the themes and the leitmotifs of Closer to Truth, that we want to explore the different traditions and understand them. And I really thank you for our conversation. I look forward to doing it more in depth at some future time where we can address these subjects even further. But thank you for participating in the Global Philosophy of Religion project, in which we hope to bring mutual understandings from different traditions.
Thank you very much, Robert, for having me on. I appreciated your stimulating questions, and I love the name Closer to Truth. One of the names of God in the 99 names is Al-Haq, the truth. So we believe in the truth. So hopefully we'll all get closer to truth with a capital T. Thank you.
Thank you.